Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin tail bro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, ha. We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general. King Khalid Muhammad, we gon' make your day a holiday. I fuck me, promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin sale pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, kid, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prisons. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Welcome back to the Michael Imhotep Show on the Apartment Radio Network, where knowledge is power. All right, we want to welcome everybody to the second hour of tonight's show. We have to give a shout-out to some of our affiliate radio stations that broadcast the Michael Imhotep Show. WCBQ 1340 AM in Oxford, North Carolina. WHNC 890 AM in Henderson, North Carolina. WBOK 1230 AM in New Orleans, Louisiana. WOLB 1010 AM in Baltimore, Maryland. You can also listen to the show by downloading the TuneIn Radio app to your Android phone, your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your tablet, and search for Empowerment Radio Network, Empowerment Radio Network, or go to TuneIn.com and search for Empowerment Radio Network, Empowerment Radio Network. All right, on the line we have Professor James Small. You've heard him on the Michael Imhotep Show before. You may have seen him in a documentary. Okay, we have him calling back in. Okay, you may have seen him in the documentary Hidden Colors 2, the Triumph of Melanin. You may have heard him on the before on the Michael Imhotep show. He has taught for a number of years at the college level. He's taught courses dealing with Pan-African studies, Pan-Africanism. He's taught for over 15 years at the City University of New York, including 13 years at the City College of New York's Black Studies Department, 13 of those years also serving as an administrator in 2 years at New York City Technical College. Now, Professor Small has also taught courses on Pan-Africanism, Malcolm X, and on comparative religions, which included several African spiritual systems titled African Religion and Survival. In 2 years at New York City Technical College, teaching the course African Folklore and Religion. Okay. All right. And okay, I know we're trying to get him back on the line. Okay. So we'll have him on in a few minutes. Okay. All right. They're trying to get him back on the line. Okay, good. Now, he's also taught Bora and in Africa. He's also taught crime in urban community and urban crisis and issues. Now, Professor James Small has been a member of the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations, better known as ASCAC, Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations, for 14 years. He has served as president of ASCAC Eastern Region for 2 years, where he worked and studied with Dr. John Henry Clark, Dr. Yosef Ben-Yakinen, Dr. Leonard Jeffries, Dr. Ivan Van Sertima, Dr. Asa Hilliard, Dr. Wade Nobles, Dr. Amos Wilson, and Dr. Francis Cress Wilson, just to name a few. And I've interviewed Dr. Jeffries is one of my teachers. Dr. John Henry Clark was a teacher to Professor Kaba Hiawatha Kamenei, Booker T. Coleman, who we had on last night. Professor Kaba Kamenei is one of my teachers. Also, Professor James Small is another one of my teachers as well. I've interviewed Dr. Francis Cress Wilson. So we're waiting on him to call back in. In the meantime, I want to let you know that coming up tomorrow, Friday, February 6th, at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History, they are doing the a screening of the documentary Five Hundred Years Later. Now, this is part of ASALA, ASALA Week, Association for the Study of African American Life and History, and they're celebrating Woodson Week, Dr. Carter G. Woodson Week. And the Association for the Study of African American Life and History was the organization that he helped co-found. Now, this screening is taking place 6 p.m. to about 8 p.m. 500 Years Later is a critically acclaimed, multi-award-winning, compelling, and timeless journey filmed on five continents. It's infused with the spirit and music of liberation. 500 Years Later chronicles the struggle of a people who have fought and continue to essential human right, self-determination. 500 Years Later, after the onset of the African Holocaust of enslavement and colonialism, Africans and people of African descent are struggling for basic freedoms. Why is this? Okay. Now, there'll be a questions and answers session afterwards, and I'm on that panel for questions and answers, so definitely come on out. It's a free event. Bring the family. There'll be vendors there also. Be sure to visit the vendor table of the African History Network as well, and come on, bring pen and pad to take notes, ask questions. I'm on the panel along with Malik Yakini. Malik Yakini is the co-founder of the Black Food Security Network. He's also the co-founder of Inseroma Institute as well, so it's going to be a good time. And you're going to learn a lot Friday, February 6th, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. We just posted this information on our Facebook fan page, The African History Network. We're going to put it on our website. It'll be in the email newsletter that goes out tomorrow, okay, Friday. And very quickly, we're going to go to Professor Small in just a second here. But Saturday at the Charles H. Wright Museum, February 7th, 12 noon to 8 p.m., there will be the first annual African World Bazaar. Now, this African World Bazaar is a unique marketplace drawing on influences from African diaspora and beyond, from textile garments to handsmith jewelry and handmade organic jams. African World Bazaar is bound to offer something special for everyone. Guests will also enjoy live performances, youth activities, arts and crafts demonstrations, and more. Okay, we're going to post this on our fan page also, The African History Network. This is taking place Saturday, February 7th at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. It's a free event. I'll be there as well. We'll have a vendor table, the African History Network also. So check that out as well. Okay, on the line we have Professor James Small. We want to welcome him to Hotep Show. How you doing, Professor Small? Hotep.
Hotep, Brother Michael. I'm nursing a cold. You know, I was hanging out in the Midwest all weekend from airport to airport trying to get home.
Yes, I understand.
But everything else is good.
That's good, brother. Well, look, it's good to have you on. Always good to talk to you. I talked to you yesterday and earlier today. And I talked to Professor Griff Tuesday night. And you and Professor Griff are doing a double lecture coming up Saturday, February 14th in Atlanta.
Yep.
And you're going to deal with African spirituality. And tonight we wanted to talk about African spirituality, awakening the God within. And because that's some of what you're going to talk about. And we've talked about this before, but it's extremely important to deal with this subject matter. And we're coming up on a break in a minute, but I want to introduction. But why is something like this? First of all, let's approach it this way. What is African spirituality? Because usually when we hear about religion, we hear about Christianity, Islam, Judaism, but we don't hear about African spirituality. What is that?
African spirituality is the understanding of nature and humans' relationship to nature and the cosmos, and the African ancestors' interpretation of the principles that govern that relationship. Out of this fundamental understanding evolved Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
Okay, and you talk about how Judaism, Christianity, Islam took fragments from the periphery.
Fragments from the periphery of the African spiritual system.
Yes, yes, okay. So when we deal with African spirituality, okay, we're about to go to break. We come back. We want to talk about when we deal with African spirituality, what are some of the most popular African spiritual systems, and among which people are they practiced? We're going to get into this on the other side of the break, okay? So just stand by. Welcome back to the Michael Imhotep Show on the Empowerment Radio Network, where knowledge is power. All right, we're speaking with Professor James Small, and we're talking about African spirituality, awakening the God. All right, Professor Small, right before the break, you gave us a good, concise overview of what African spirituality is, or a definition of what African spirituality is. And one of the questions I had right before the break was, what are some of the most popular African spiritual systems, and what are their names, and which people are they practiced by?
Yeah, and in North America, we find a lot of people who are practicing the Yoruba tradition or the African spiritual system as the Yoruba practice it. There's no such thing as a Yoruba religion or a Yoruba spiritual system. A religion is a tool of spirituality, so every people will develop the religion to interpret their spirituality to themselves. And so the Yoruba practice is heavily used. The Yoruba people live in West Africa and what is now Nigeria. Also, we practice heavily, you see people practicing the Akan tradition. The Akans are people living in Benin. We see them practice in the Voodoo tradition. Mm-hmm. And Benin is also in West Africa, bordering on Nigeria. We will also see the Voodoo tradition practice in Haiti. We'll see it practice in New Orleans and other parts of southern Mississippi and Louisiana. We'll see the Candomblé tradition practice in Brazil.
And you'll see pronounce that again, Candomblé? Pronounce that again?
Candomblé.
Okay, Candomblé.
Yes. And then there's Lukome. That's what they call the tradition, one of the tradition practice in Cuba. And Santeria is the tradition practice in Puerto Rico by Africans there. All of them are practicing the very same system, the very same spiritual system, following the very same cosmology and the very same laws of nature and relationship to nature, and how each culture uses religion as a tool to interpret that spirituality to themselves.
Right.
So if we look at the Yoruba, we'll see people who are very familiar with that one in North America, where they talk about the Orishas. And some say, the Orishas are the gods. But no, there's no African word calling the Orishas gods. They are forces in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And these forces in nature, which Western science calls some of them the laws of nature, these forces in nature, ancient Africans related to them just as we relate to the laws of nature today, how they function, how they affect us, how we affect them, how we impact on them, how they impact on us. And the idea is, how do you keep harmony between you and all of the aspects of nature that you're able to, and how do you keep harmony between you and the cosmology, the cosmos, things above the earth that affects you every day, and you affect them with your thoughts, with your actions, and your behavior. And we're talking matter and energy interacting with each other. But you teach this through allegory and through folklore and through metaphor, as well as rituals and ceremonies and celebrations that involving dancing and music. It involves mastering the science of understanding herbology and the natural medicine that goes in the ecology and how to apply that medically to the lives of the people in the community you're living in. And that the Africans saw medicine as being a spiritual thing, not just a scientific thing. And so you didn't separate your science from your spirituality. Your spirituality and your science is what made it, and your understanding of science that makes up your reality. So I often say spirituality is reality. It's being conscious of the moment you're living in and being guided by the wisdom of our collective ancestors and the divine laws of nature.
Right.
Now, how this plays out in what we call religion, I'll give you an example.
Okay.
See, I'm a priest of Oya.
Mm-hmm.
Oya is considered to be an Orisha, which some people call a god, but there is no god called Oya. Mm-hmm. Orisha is a force of nature. In the Yoruba language, you're referring to something that is a force, a phenomena, a function in nature that has multiple ways of expressing itself. One of the ways the force we call Oya expresses itself, it expresses itself as change and process. So if I want to tell us, want to do a metaphor about Oya, I would have to use something that represents change. So I would describe Oya as the wind, because the wind represents change. It blows away the stale, and it brings in the new. And so the metaphor in the Yoruba culture of an Oya, one of the metaphors is how she saves the king, Shango. Shango, who's a king, represents the aspect of royalty in the human character, represents the courage to change yourself to a higher spirit, a better person. But once you get the courage to change yourself, that courage must do what? It must marry change. So Shango, the courage, the awareness of the courage within a human consciousness to want to change itself, must marry change and process in that same human being's consciousness to go to the next step. And then now that Shango and Oya is married, the need for change, marrying change, then in the metaphor, the beautiful woman who represents change, called Oya, has to marry the god of war, the god of iron, Ogun. Why? Because Ogun represents transformation. You know, you take to get iron, you take a rock, and you put it in the fire, and you burn out the impurities, and you come with iron or steel. Well, that's the result of transformation. So the need for change, Shango, marries change in process, Oya, who then in turn becomes polyandrous and marries transformation as a result of the change, which is called Ogun. You understand what I just said?
Yes, yes.
So this, when you understand how, you remember, most people were not literate in the way we are literate today.
Right.
And read language. Very few people in the inner circle did that. But they were literate in terms of the cultural tools that were used to teach fundamental ideas, principles, and concepts. And that's what metaphor and allegory and folklore were used to do. And that's where dance and drama and music comes in to help teach these concepts so everyone in the society had an equal understanding of the fundamental laws of science, of the laws of nature, of an understanding the cosmos, astrology, and astrology's knowledge and relationship to everything we did here on Earth. When you put all of that together, which should be called African sacred science, then you're talking about African spirituality or religiosity.
Okay. How should most African Americans are of a Christian persuasion? So how
we're going to have to stop saying Christian persuasion. Let's stop saying European Christian persuasion.
Okay, European Christian. Okay, yeah.
Because people will try to escape out of that and say, well, yeah, you know, we had Christians and Africans. Yes, most enslaved Africans who came to America were either Christians or Muslims before they were captured and enslaved. But most Africans in Africa who were enslaved, who were Christians or Muslims, still practiced their traditional system as well. Since we invented Christianity and Islam at a periphery of our society where we're being invaded by outsiders in the area we now call Egypt or Northeast Africa. And so the very people that we had converted to that came back and for 1,500 years before the transatlantic slave trade, through wars and murder and genocide, carried on the Trans-Sahara slave trade and the Indian Ocean slave trade. These were the Arabs and Turkish Muslims who were enslaving and murdering and practicing genocide on Africans before Christopher Columbus was born. And so that in the course of that, millions of us became Muslims. And even before we became Muslims, millions of us were Christians. Some of the oldest Christian churches in the world, one of the 10 oldest Christian churches in the world is in Ethiopia.
Right. The ruins of two of the
15 oldest churches is in the Sudan. So we were practicing a form of Christianity before there was Christianity in England or France or Germany.
Right. The one in Ethiopia, how far back does that go, the Christian church in Ethiopia?
It goes back to the 5th century.
AD.
What we see in Ethiopia, let's not confuse it, that's the Byzantine church that comes out of Turkey. But that time Turkey was a multi-ethnic, black, Asiatic mixed community. That is the church that produced the church in Ethiopia. But the Ethiopian gave it its own character by incorporating its ancient Egyptian aspects into it.
Okay, hold that thought. I'm going to take a quick break. Okay, hold on just a second, Professor Small. We'll continue this on the other side of the break, okay?
Yes.
All right, you listen to the Michael Imhotep Show on the Empowerment Radio Network with Knowledge is Power. You can give us a call, 888. Welcome back to the Michael Imhotep Show on the Empowerment Radio Network where knowledge is power. Everything is everything. All right, that's some Lauryn Hill for you. Okay, we're speaking with Professor James Small. You've seen him in Hidden Colors 2, The Triumph of Melanin. You've heard him on the Michael Imhotep Show before in the African History Network show. He's very, very knowledgeable, brother. And right before the break, we were talking about African spirituality. We were talking about an original form of Christianity, if you want to put it that way. So, Professor Small, right before the break, you were making a distinction between the Christianity that Africans practice historic and the Christianity that was imposed upon us by Europeans. And go ahead and finish with the point you were making before the break.
Yes, sir. The Christianity that we are practicing now was born in France and England. It has very little to do with the early Christian church, the church that we call the Byzantine church, which is born before the Catholic church. Okay? It is not that Byzantine church, which is put together by African minds. And the Pope, the last Pope said when he was in Cameroon in 2009, that of the 10 scholars that wrote the original theology of the church, 7 were Africans. This is the Pope saying this. And so the church as we knew it in the Byzantine, and we call it the Byzantine kingdom, but people don't realize that the Byzantine rulership was the rulership of the first Christian church. and out of the Catholic Church will be created as a counter to that. Today, the Byzantine Church is called the Eastern Orthodox.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they've lost much of their ancient tradition, but the Ethiopian and the Egyptian Coptic Church has, to this day, the character of the original church, out of which all other aspects of Christianity evolved. And so many Africans who came to this country as enslaved Africans came out of those traditions, out of the tradition of Ethiopia, out of the tradition of the Christian tradition in Sudan, out of the Islamic tradition of the Fatimite dynasty out of West Africa, which is quite different from the Turkish Sunni Shia phenomena we see today. And so, but all of these people at the same time, and you will find it's going on right now. If you go to Ghana and you go to a mosque and you see an imam, the odds are almost 10 to 1 that that imam is also a traditional spiritual leader. You understand?
So you're saying, even though you're saying in addition to practicing Islam, he's also practicing a traditional African spiritual system. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Because they're viewing it quite differently from the way we're doing it. They're viewing Islam and Christianity as simply a modernized aspect of their tradition.
Okay.
You understand?
Yeah,
because Islam and Christianity only deals with a historical phenomenon that takes place in Egypt and in what we call the Middle East, Saudi Arabia. That we call Christianity, everything we call Islam, everything we call Judaism, takes place in the northern part of Egypt, in the area we call Israeli Palestine, and in the Red Sea shores of what is called Saudi Arabia. The history of those three religions take place there. As Africans are trying to free themselves with Judaism, they're trying to free themselves from the control of the Hyksos. With Christianity, it comes as a result of a resistance movement of African spirituality trying to free themselves from the domination of the Roman and the Greek descendants. And Islam will come as again to free itself from the domination of the Romans and other Europeans who had colonized and settled that area. So the three religions, we call the three Western religions, really started out as African spiritual liberation movements that evolved into religion when Westerners got hold of the concept and used it to help rape. Is that clear enough?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, look, we have... go ahead.
No, then when you go back to African...
We're going to... You said go back to what now?
When you go back to African spirituality, then you're talking about reality. How human beings saw themselves in relationship to everything else that existed, including the divinity out of which Africans says all things evolved. Our first ancestor is God itself.
Okay. Look, we have a caller. Let's go to the caller quickly here. Caller, welcome to the Michael Imhotep Show. Tell us your name, where you're calling from. Do we have the caller? Okay, we lost him. Okay, let me know what's going on with the caller. Okay, all right. Now, let me ask you a question here. From my understanding, from my research and talking to various scholars, of those Africans who were brought here to what we call the United States during the transatlantic slave trade, Is it accurate to say, even though some of them were Christian, is it accurate to say the majority of them were Muslims?
No, the majority were not Muslims. The majority were traditional African spiritualists.
Okay, there we go. Okay.
The overwhelming majority were people who practiced their traditional spiritual relationship to the rest of the universe and nature.
Okay. Okay, yeah.
I got to say it like that, because when we try to talk about it like a religion, spirituality is not a religion. Religion is a tool of spirituality. Spiritual tool of religion. And the religion that we are practicing now, the theology that we are practicing now called Christianity, is not the same theology that was a part of the way of life of the Africans who were captured and brought here.
Okay. And that's what I thought, because I know, and oftentimes that part is left out, that about the Africans who practice traditional African spiritual systems as well. So the majority
of enslaved Africans practice traditional African spiritual tradition. The overwhelming majority. And even those who practice what we're calling Christianity or Islam also practice African spiritual tradition and still do that the same way till this day. I put in at least 4 or 5 months a year in Africa for most of the last 30 years, each year, and have friends in every aspect of the continent and in every aspect of the cultural tradition. And when I go down with my brothers up in Sikandi and other places, and we do Ramadan, but they do the spiritual system too. My spiritual leader, the priest that I go to have my reading done and to have certain special things done on my behalf, he's also an imam of a major Muslim community. He's an imam, and he's also a spiritual leader, and they see no contradiction in that. They're not caught up in the European, Arab, Turkish Sharia, which has nothing to do with African reality.
Right. So they'll practice Islam and then also practice traditional African spiritual systems and don't see a contradiction in the two of them.
The Islam of the Prophet Muhammad has nothing to do with the Turkish, European Sharia.
Okay, you're dealing with a different Islam. Yeah.
Yes, sir. And I'm speaking as a person who spent 18 years as an imam and went to Mecca twice before that.
Okay.
You know.
Okay. Right. So that's why we have to have that clarification. Okay. All right, look, we're coming up on a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about this some more. So just stand by. Okay, listen to the Michael Imhotep Show on the Empowerment Radio Network, where knowledge is power. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 888-669-2281. 888-669-2281. We'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to the Michael Imhotep Show on the Empowerment Radio Network. All right, we're speaking with Professor James Small, and we're talking about African spirituality, awakening the God within. I want to remind you that Saturday, February 14th, 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. in Atlanta, Georgia, Professor James Small will be doing a double presentation. It will be Professor James Small and Professor Griff of the legendary hip-hop group Public Enemy. They will be at Vickers at 838 Cascade Avenue, Southwest Atlanta, Georgia. For more information and to get tickets, you can go to the.connection.net, the.connection.net. Also, you can call Patricia Patton at 323-929-24, 323-929-7724. You can call Professor Griff at 678-557-2919, 678-557-2919. Tickets in advance online are $20. For students with ID is $15. For children 12 to 17, $10. At the door purchases, general admission is $25. Students with ID, $20. Children ages 12 to 17, $10. It's a double presentation. Professor Small will deal with African spirituality, and Professor Griff will deal with the God frequency. So you don't want to miss this. I'll be there as well. The African History Network will be in the house. I'll be there. Be sure to visit the vendor table of the African History Network at this event also. We have this on our Facebook fan page, The African History Network. We'll put it on our website also. We should have it up on the website tomorrow. Okay, let's go back to Professor Small. Professor Small, you still there? Okay. All right. Look, we have a caller on line 9. Let's try to get this call in. Caller, welcome to the Michael Imhotep Show. How you doing tonight? Tell us your name, where you're calling from. Caller, are you there? Line 9? Can we get the call on line 9? If you're on the cell phone, hit the mute button because we can't hear you. Okay. Okay, the caller, okay, they're shy, they hung up, okay. All right, now let me ask you a question. You and I have talked about this before. When you talked about the Moors and you talked about the Turks in Morocco, okay? When we deal with that, the Treaty of Peace and Friendship, 1786, with Morocco, dealing with Morocco. Who was in power there, and who was that treaty with?
Treaty was with the Turks. The Turks took over the Ottoman Turks took over the from the Arab world in the 10th century, and by the 14th century, it was the white Muslim, the Ottoman Turks, that helped destroy the black Moorish rule of Spain. And we don't study history, and we just take labels. Morocco, you know, some right now the people in Morocco who rule, you still got black people living in Morocco. And the word Moor is simply the Romanization, the Anglicization of the Romanization of the Greek word for black. Why is it that so complicated? And nobody in Africa called themselves a Moor.
Right.
White folks called us that.
Right.
You know? And we need to stop trying to find ways to separate ourselves from the rest of the black folks. That's why we're in trouble.
Right.
You know? Moors is just a European way of saying black.
Right, right. It comes from Morose, the Greek Morose.
The treaty was not signed with the black folks. The treaty was signed with the Turkish Ottoman Empire.
Because we had lost power then.
Until the First World War.
Right, because we were out of power in Morocco.
Right, most of the people who lived in Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and Libya, the original African people, they now live in parts of Mauritania, in Senegal, in Mali, in Niger, in Gambia. Those people got pushed down by the invading white people, who we are calling Arabs. They're not even Arabs. These are Eastern European Serbs and Tunics and Turks from the Caucasus Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
They took over the Islamic system as early as the 8th century. They were forced to share leadership in North Africa with the black folks, who the white folks write about as Moors, because they wanted to save black folks from the black folks they were enslaving in America. So in their literature, we get to this term Moors. You don't get that from any African literature.
Right, and that became became a general term.
It's simply a European word for black. It has its roots in Greece and Rome.
Right, right.
And the Moors is just the Anglicization of the Roman word for black.
Right.
If we can get that piece straight, we can start looking at the history and make sense of it. Right now, we're talking like there was some mystical black folks named Moors who got some special relationship with the white murderers and rapers and genociders of Africa, and they got some special relationship with this demon that puts them above the rest of the black folks. What's wrong with people?
Exactly, exactly.
They need to stop it.
And from my research, when these Africans who are known as Moors go into Europe, that 800-year occupation of Europe by these Africans.
They were in partnership with the Arabs and later with the Eastern Europeans and the Turks. We never occupied Europe by ourselves, okay?
That's
another myth.
Right, right.
And all the literature will tell you that it was the black people of North Africa and the Arabs' counterpart, because we were not Muslims until the Arabs got there. Abu al-As being the first general to invade North Africa as a Muslim leader, and followed by what gets to be known as the Umayyad dynasty, which will be followed by what's the dynasty when they get overthrown?
The Almoravids?
The Almoravids. Those are the two black folks that lived there in North Africa. One on the coast, even before the Arabs and the Romans invade. Had an invasion of the Visigoths through Spain. These are the Germans who themselves originated in the same Caucasus Mountains and move as the Ostrogoths down through Eastern Europe and end up in Western Europe as the Visigoths. They invade and occupy North Africa. So with each invasion, you get rape and plundering, and you get a mulattization of the population on the coast.
Right.
And then there's a war between the Almoravids and the Almoravids, because this is the black population fighting against the mulatto population who had adopted the way of their white enslavers.
Right.
It's very complex. This is not a simple history to explain. It's very complex history.
And
out of the same mix, you get Hannibal, and some of these same dynamics is already existing.
Absolutely.
You know? By the time you get the Roman invasion, listen, all of North Africa is invaded by the Romans and occupants for hundreds of years before the Arab Muslim invasion. So the Romans are there raping and plundering and pillaging and mulattizing the coastal blacks in North Africa from the Atlantic to the Nile.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get it right. Let's tell them.
Welcome to Rhythm of Justice Television with Brother Salim Madafo. Today we are here with Professor James Small, and we're going to discuss different African traditional ceremonies and rituals. What you just saw was what we call a libation, and it was done in a village in West Africa, in Ghana to be specific. But Baba, can you tell the audience exactly what is a libation?
Yes, a libation is what an African do before they open any ceremony, before any other kind of prayers or discussion. They use spirits. It used to be palm wine, now they use a form of gin. We use over here water, and we pour it to the earth. They refer to the earth as a sasia, Mother Earth.
Right.
And in pouring it to the earth, we are pouring it to, first you raise it up to God Almighty, asking God Almighty, because all African cultures believe in the oneness of God. And after you've made the gesture to God Almighty, offering refreshments and drinks, then you pour it to the Mother Earth and to the ancestors, asking them to bless and guide whatever endeavor you're about to embark upon. You also pour to the forces of nature. In Ghana, they call Obosum.
Okay.
In the Yoruba land, they call Orisha. In Haiti, they call Lowas. But you're talking about the forces of nature, which in America they call the laws of physics.
Mm.
And so we know how to use and manipulate these energy forms.
Mm.
And so we pour to them in respect. We pour to our ancestors in respect. Because all Africans who understand their culture realize that we are the ancestors. We are the DNA of millions upon millions of years, and billions of ancestors culminate into us. And so when we pour that libation, we are appealing to our own consciousness as well as the collective consciousness to access the memory that is ancestry, so we can develop the imagination which is necessary to create the next movement or moment.
Now, oftentimes people try to say that this is something spooky, or this is that voodoo stuff and we're eating people and killing people. And I tell people with a libation, it's nothing more than what we see many people do all of the time. It's every time someone takes a drink, what do they say? We're going to pour a little out for everybody who's not
libation
here.
Libation is mentioned in the document they call the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see our culture simulated eating human beings, but their religious culture simulate eating the body of a human and drinking their blood. We don't, our culture don't do that.
Right.
We pay respects to the earth. We pay respects to the cosmos. We pay respects to the ancestors. We pay respects to divinity. We pay respects to the forces of nature, which comes from the divinity.
Right.
The African word in every language for the divine or for what we call the one God is called the totality of creation itself.
Right. Okay. Now, when we're talking about ancestral worship, I think that from my experiences in traditional African societies, that we do acknowledge the people who have gone on before us, but that is no different than what we see in some other
places. We don't worship our ancestors.
Right.
We revere our ancestors because we are our ancestors. You are the culmination of the DNA of your mother and your father, and they were of the four, their mothers and fathers.
Correct.
And they were of the eight, their mothers and fathers, and they were of the 16, and they were of the 32, and they were of the 64, etc.
Right.
All of it culminate in you. You are they genetically, and you also they in terms of the emotions and the essence of the life, the vibrations and the sounds they made when that impacted you.
Yes, sir.
So when we talk about revering our ancestors, we have in our systems, in the Yoruba system, a concept called Awu. We believe in all African cultures in reincarnation, that when we die, we are reborn again, not as an animal, not as a snake or a tree, but as a human being in the same family. In the Yoruba, we call it the Ibi, the same family unit that we first were born into the earth in. We constantly keep coming back in that unit, renewing that unit, and that each of us is an ancestor come back. And African Americans know this very well, especially in the South. Anytime a child is born, we want to know who that, who done come back now. Is this auntie so-and-so? Is this titty so-and-so? Is this mama so-and-so? Is this father so-and-so? So we retain that, and yet we reject it when we have to describe it, because we have been so imbued in the European way of worshiping God that we are afraid, even though they may not work for us very well, given our conditions in America. And I think there was a study done in Sweden twice in the last 20 years of who's the most religious worship in the world, and it's been deemed the African Americans. It doesn't seem like God is listening very well, or we're not talking the right language.
Right.
So maybe we need to show more respect for our mothers and our fathers, and maybe our days will be longer upon this earth which God has given thee, because we have rejected our mothers and fathers, and our respect is towards the murderers and the rapists of our mothers and fathers. And we need to let that sink in.
Yes, sir.
Without getting confused.
Now, one of the terms that you used earlier was Yoruba. Can you explain what that means?
There's a people that live in Nigeria, and we call that nation today Yorubas. And their religious methodologies is one of the dominant African religious methodology that we use in the Western Hemisphere, because they're one of the last group of Africans captured and brought into the Americas, and in large numbers, because there was a major war going on among them during the latter 1700s and early 1800s. So the last layer is the one that we tend to refer to most. And so when you see someone from Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, or Cuba practicing Santeria, or from Cuba practicing Lucome, or from the South Carolina practicing Root, or what they call Hoodoo, or from Haiti practicing Voodoo, you're seeing much of the traditions of how the Yoruba people practice their relationship to divinity and to ancestry being manifest as a religious form. Even though we didn't call it a religion in Africa, it was just our cultural reality.
Right.
And the divine was a part of our everyday life.
Right.
But in the Western context, now we want to be capitalists, exploiters, and then on the side, we have a religion where we go and pay respects to God. In Africa, the thing that we call religion was the whole way of life.
Right.
It wasn't an aside. And so now we have it as an aside. But that's what we're referring to, how the Yoruba people approach this understanding of divinity and this understanding of the human beingness of the human being.
So something else I wanted to touch on is a lot of terms that we hear, but oftentimes we don't know what they mean. What does the term Igungun mean?
It simply means ancestors.
Okay.
The Igungun means ancestors, and we do rituals at certain times of year, where we appeal to the ancestors to come into our affairs and help us solve our problems. You see it, any church you go in, people be calling on Isaac, Esau, Jacob, and Abraham. They're all dead folks in the Bible. They're ancestors. And so the Christian religion, the Jewish religion, the Muslim religion, the Abrahamic three religions call upon their dead ancestors all the time. But when we call upon ours, there's something wrong with it. They even call upon a dead God having come alive, and they find that appropriate, but they find it inappropriate when we do it, because this culture has taught us to hate ourselves to such a degree that we hate our mothers and our fathers, and we hate the culture and the spiritual system that our mother and fathers have bequeathed us. Right. And so we've accepted that of our enemies as being most appropriate, whether it works or not.
What is an orisha?
Orisha is simply the forces of nature. A human being could be an orisha if you live a good enough life, if you live a righteous life, and you create an environment with your energy and your spirit that others can adopt and adapt to live a righteous life, then you would be called an orisha, because that example you set becomes a power in the environment to be emulated and imitated by the next generation.
Oh, wow.
And so there are forces in nature that people can appeal to, you know. When you eat collard greens, you know, you eat, oh, the food, I love collard greens. This is a good soul food. But what you're doing is ingesting iron. So your sister, that piece of leaf, has took the energy from the sun, the radiation from the sun, broken it down into a form of iron that you can use in your body to help you stay strong and healthy. And you can eat your sister, the green leaf, and get the strength from the sun. And we never think of it. And we don't even think of the leaf as our sister. Or our sister, the tree, can take the poison that you call carbon dioxide and absorb it out of the air so you don't die, and then give you oxygen so that you might live, but we'll chop her down and mutilate her without even thinking about her. In Africa, we would go to that tree and say, oh, my dear sister, my beloved brother, I need you, and I hope you please forgive me because I have to take your life because I need to use you for this or that or this. And we laugh and think that's foolish. But get rid of that tree and see how quickly you live on this earth. And then you'll know how to love it and
about
respect
that.
It. Now that's what we're talking about.
Now, there's another term that I often hear, and it's called Babalawo. What is a Babalawo?
Yeah, Babalawo, in the Yoruba language, it means the father of wisdom.
Okay.
Okay. So Baba means father. The Olawo means the wisdom. You're talking about the wisdom of nature, that those brothers and sisters who go into the priesthood and master what we call physics and chemistry and biology, because that's what you're talking about.
Right.
They master the wisdom of nature. And so you become a Babalawo, or like for me, I'm a Babalorisha. I deal with a specific force, a specific understanding called Oya, which is the psychological notion of change and process, what stimulates and causes changes in an individual and in a collective, and what is the result of change, and what is the necessity that produces that change, and why one should adhere to that in order to psychologically be healthy. So my thing is to master that notion called Oya, and that makes me a Babalorisha of Oya. And someone who's a Babalawo looks at the total system and tends to try and explain what we would call in our science the laws of physics and its ramifications in the world.
And another term that I often hear is an Ile. What is an Ile?
That's like a grouping, a family collective. My Ile would be those persons that I've taught to master this part of the science that I think I'm the master of.
Okay.
That would be my Ile, those teachers that I've taught, and I was sent out into the community to teach others to understand the basic laws that affects their lives on a daily basis, that if they learn these basic principles of behavior and attitudes, that they can alter and change their lives considerably for the better.
All right. We need to take a break. You're watching Rhythm and Justice Television with Brother Salim Adafo. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Rhythm and Justice Television with Brother Salim Adafo. Today we are here with Professor James Small. And one of the things that we're discussing is our different traditions that come from the continent.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes I hear sisters and brothers say, well, that's the African stuff. I'm not into that. And then when I see someone pass, we'll see someone create what we call like a shrine on the altar. Mm-hmm. And then they'll put up some balloons. They'll put up some candles.
They do the African thing.
And they'll have someone's favorite drink there. Mm-hmm. In my neighborhood is usually E&J. Some people put a bottle of Henny. And that's called an altar or a shrine, if I'm correct, right? Mm-hmm. And that's something out of our tradition. Mm-hmm. Can you touch on the significance of an altar?
Right. It's about remembrance. We see in our community someone die in that location. You said the first thing we'll see some candles lit there, and sometimes if those know it, then you see multiple colors representing.
Right.
Each of the forces of nature has a color according to African science. And so people will put these different colors, and I realize blue represents motherhood and nurturing. Yellow represents both courage and beauty, the Yoshun. Brown represents Oya, the notion of change. Black and red represents the need to make a decision. And so they bring these things together, not knowing what they're doing, but it's coming from their subconscious, their collective African subconscious. And so an altar is a place where you go and concentrate your energy and thoughts towards the spirit that was lost from the body.
And it's so deep that I don't want to say that one is based out of the other. I'm not sure, but it could be, and that's why we have you here to bring some clarity to it. But what is the difference between speaking in tongues and being what we call possessed in the tradition? Catching what they call it in the Christian church, the Holy Ghost.
There is no difference except in language.
Right.
One is a denial. We call it the Holy Ghost in denial of our Africanism. And so we try to identify it with the European religious expression.
Right.
Yet if you go into the European church, you don't see these things. You see them in the African American churches. And what the African-American has done is to bring Africa into their church. But because they have very little knowledge of African history and culture, they can't recognize the African retentions that are in the churches. You know, and so a lot of the things we see, the clapping rhythm we do, you can find those drum rhythms all over Africa, the stomping rhythm we do. When we call ourselves shouting in churches, those are dance steps that would be copied from our aunties and grandmothers. And they copied from their great-grandmothers who brought those dance steps from Africa. Those are ethnic dance steps.
Right.
You can actually go into church and film those ethnic dance steps and trace them back to the very village in Africa the people came from. So we need to study African history so we can recognize the African things we've retained in our American culture.
How important is ritual to us?
All religions rely on ritual. All religions is made up of ritual, mystery, and what do you call it? All of them have mystery. All of them have ritual.
Their cosmology, their folklore?
The folklore comes into them. That's their mystery.
Okay.
And so ritual is simply how you play it out. A dance is a ritual.
Mm.
A musical piece is a ritual. A drama done is a ritual. Mm. So rituals are the method you use to interpret your mystery, you know? And your mystery is your body of knowledge that you're trying to explain to yourself.
Yeah. All right. Now, another culture that is very dominant here in the States, and we saw this when we had the chance to travel to Ghana, is the Akan tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to us some aspects of the Akan tradition?
Well, the Akans are the people, that's an ethnic grouping, meaning a cultural grouping.
Yeah.
Genetically, they're the same people as the Yorubas and the Ewes. They're all genetically, most of them the same people, 99%. But ethnically, in terms of the cultural development, they differ, language differ. So the Akans live primarily in Ghana and Ivory Coast. And they refer what we call Orishas, the forces of nature, in the Yoruba tradition, they call the Obosun.
Okay.
In the Akan tradition, but they're talking about the very same thing. When we talk about a priest, you're talking about someone who may be a physician, a botanist, a herbalist, a pharmaceutical person, an agricultural person. A priest is someone who master a certain body of knowledge that is essential for the harmonious functioning of the society.
Mm-hmm.
And the job of that man or woman who's in that position is to teach that body of knowledge or use it to explain what's going on in society to the general population.
Gotcha.
That's what it is. But we've turned it into the Christian thing of a priest, which is a preacher that only talks about religious theology. The African priest covers the spectrum of sacred science, mm-hmm. what we call science today.
What is an ikom?
An ikom is simply it's a religious ritual and ceremony
mm-hmm.
that is done to bring down certain forces.
Mm.
People say, well, what kind of force you bring down? The same thing you bring down when you go in church and clap and shout until someone gets the grace and pass out. That's the kind of force. That's an ikom.
Okay.
In a Christian church, if you were in a traditional African community, that would be called an ikom.
Okay.
What you would do when you go to that Christian church and you come up with a number like, save me, Lord, save me, Lord, oh, save me. And you just beat that rhythm and that dance until somebody just jump up and start screaming and hollering. Well, that's an ikom, people.
Mm.
Okay. Where you bring the spirit into a human body and it demonstrates itself in dance and movement, that's extraordinary to everybody else who don't feel that thing.
All right, we need to take one more break. You're watching Rhythm and Justice Television with Brother Salim Adolfo. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Rhythm and Justice Television with Brother Salim Adolfo. Today we are here discussing different traditional African spiritual concepts, and we have Professor James Small here. Baba, can you tell us what is we're talking about Orisha, but specifically there are different kinds of Orisha. We're talking mm-hmm. about, for example, Shango. Can you explain mm-hmm. the concept of Shango?
Mm-hmm. Shango in the Yoruba tradition mm-hmm. Is referred to, and he's supposed to have been a king, an mm-hmm. Alafin, who had lived a negative, egocentric life
right.
and had caused harm to people. In one instance where he had his two brothers fight to the death of one of them. And then he ran away into the forest and he committed suicide. And that's one of the folklore about Shango. But the story of Shango as an essence, as a force of nature, is about that thing within a human being that compels them that they need to change themselves for the better.
Okay.
That compelling, that force that says your life has been a negative and something rises up inside of you that's powerful enough to reverse your course, to tell you you need to change. And then Shango must go out and marry Oya, this beautiful woman with the locks running through the forest who have the ability to turn into a deer or an antelope and is considered to be the wind because Oya represents change okay. in process. Once the courage for the need to change, which we call Shango, impacts the human consciousness, it must go into Oya, the process of change itself. And the process of change of itself that Oya must now practice what in the folklore is called polyandry, where the woman married more than one man. Mm. So she must marry the god Ogun, the god of iron.
Okay.
The god of war. But what is that? It is the notion of transformation. Because in order to make metal and to create the implements of war and to create iron, you must take a stone, a rock, or something, put it to heat, put it to fire, burn out the impurities, and transform it into this thing you can use now to make tools and weapons.
Right.
And so Oya represents transformation as a result of change. You understand that?
Yes, sir.
The need for change, Shango, recognizing the need for change, the courage to carry out change, must marry change in process, which is Oya itself, who must then marry Ogun, which is transformation as a result of change.
All right.
That's another, what we're talking about.
Okay. Another Orisha that's very popular, and I think is because of the movie Love Jones, is Yemoya.
Yemoya mm-hmm. is the mother.
Okay.
It is the nurturer. So Yemoya is considered to be the water, the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And Yemoya in our tradition is that part of the water where photosynthesis takes place.
Mm.
Once you get to the point where no sunlight is penetrating and there's no photosynthesis, you're talking about, that's called getting old. Olokun.
Okay.
Olokun is the darkness. and Nolokun is the father, and Yemaja is the mother, and the photosynthesis is where light is germinated with the sunlight penetrating. And so she represents the nurturing in nature, the sustainer of life when it comes into being.
Yes, sir.
And so that's Yemaja. The other one is Oshun.
Right.
Oshun is considered to be sexy, beautiful, sensual, but that's the Western mythology. She's presented as this most beautiful woman. She's more often presented as the Holy Mother and Child, as the Madonna. And Oshun represents the extraordinary courage and fire. Matter of fact, in our tradition, we have Ifa, mm-hmm. And Ramila, who does the divining with the kauri shells, right. And that, we're not going to even go into that right. system. But before Ramila was given that task, Oshun had that task. But she had a hole in her pocket, and she lost the kauri, so her brother picked them up, and he used them. That's a longer story
right.
in our folklore. But the beautiful thing about Oshun is one story I should get to people. It's called the story of the War of Women.
Uh-huh.
And so there was war going on between the women, and it was a vicious war. So Oludumari, the Almighty God, sends the elders to try and squill this war. And the elders come and say, oh, Oludumari, there's nothing we can do. These women won't listen to anything. So he sent all the senior Orishas, and they go down. The women beat the daylights out, and they come back up to heaven and tell Oludumari, we can't do anything with these women. Oshun come marching in with her water pot on her head, and she's dancing with her rhythm and her music. And Oshun say, oh, Oludumari, let me, Oshun, go. I will go to earth, and I will settle this one. Everybody left, oh, Oshun, you go and keep looking cute. Keep acting pretty. Keep being the soft girl. And Oludumari said, no, let Oshun go. Oshun goes to earth, and she hears the violence and the chaos and the confusion, and she starts singing, and she starts dancing, and she starts playing her instruments, and she creates harmony. And thus she creates balance. And the woman hears this, and they start fighting. They start dancing. They start singing. And they create harmony and balance. So the Oshun that we know of Yoruba is also the Ma'at of Kemet.
Now, you touched on something that I want to really try to get some understanding of. And you said the different ceremonies and the dancing and the drumming. How significant is drumming and dancing for African spiritual systems?
Drumming is an emulation of the human heartbeat at certain segments, okay? So drumming is absolutely essential because when we go to the doctor, they take your pulse. But in the West, we only take one pulse. Mm. The human body has 8 pulse. If you went to have acupuncture, they would take 8 pulse and not one pulse. So drum rhythm represents these different pulses in the human body.
Okay.
And so when you play that rhythm, and is recognized by that pulse, you form a partnership. That's how black folks can do it, because you're hooked up
right.
to that rhythm.
So I got
because those beats are simulating the very rhythms of your body
right.
and of nature. So the pulsation of the earth, and the earth pulsates. There's also pulsations in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have relationship. The tree pulsates, the wind, everything has a rhythm.
Right.
And so on the drums, depending on what they're playing for, that determines what rhythm is being played, you see. And drums are a sacred thing. There's a book called Drumology written by a brother from Cote d'Ivoire named Niangora Bura. Professor Bura is now an ancestor. And the book is in French, but it tells the story of a drum, drumology, and the science of drumming itself. And in the sacred cult, we can call it a sacred cult of drummers, one starts is picked at 4 years old to be a drummer, so he'll not play in the open until he's 40. He's trained all those years, and he has to pick a tree. As the tree grows, he grows.
Oh, right.
When he's a little boy, and so when he gets to the age to make his drum, he makes it from that tree that he has built this extraordinary relationship with, and then the same thing with the monkey whose skin he will use.
Wow.
To build that drum. So that drum, that wood, that drum, and that child has had a relationship from age 4.
Well, we're running out of time. You're watching Rhythm and Justice Television. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for joining me. I have a special guest with me. He is an instructor, teacher, educator. He's instructed at universities such as City University of New York, City College of New York, as a forerunner in the Black Studies Department, and New York City Technical College. He has taught on subjects such as, but not limited to, traditional African religion, Pan-Africanism, crime in urban communities, urban crisis issues, and African folklore. He travels extensively lecturing throughout the United States, the Caribbean, and Africa. His informative, eye-opening, and dynamic presentations have offered him the honor of being recognized as one of the most distinguished scholars of our time. Please help me welcome speaker, educator, activist, and CEO, Professor James Small. Professor, how are you doing today?
I'm good, my brother. Peace and blessings. How are you doing?
Excellent. Welcome. I'm so glad you had the opportunity and the time to join us today. We want to discuss the history of racism, particularly here in America. But before we dig and unpack that, let's talk about America as a country in general. We've learned, I know in our grade schools and beyond, that a particular gentleman discovered America. From your vantage point, what is your understanding of the origin of America as a country?
People play with that. I don't like to play games that don't make sense. You know, I have people saying, oh, well, it's a corporation. It's not a country. Please, who is it incorporated under? You know, stop playing games. A country is a place where a group of people take over a piece of real estate and control it militarily and thus control it politically and make the laws that govern it. And no matter where you do it on earth, if you're able to do that, it's your country. You know, we could play silly games. But we've been here since 1619. Most of us, there were some Africans here when the Europeans got here. We were here when the Native Americans, so-called, they're not Native Americans. They're immigrants from the Bering Strait in Mongolia. They're Asiatics. We call them Indians. But when they got here, we were already here because Africans are the Aborigines everywhere on the planet. We were in Australia. We were in New Guinea. We were in India. We were in Europe. Everywhere on the planet, we were there first. But we were for 10,000 years fighting against the so-called Indians who met us here when they got here, okay? Both in Central South America and in North America, we had to battle them. And in some cases, we made peace and amalgamated with them. But some of us were still here as in our African genetic structuring. And then we had a few centuries before Columbus, the Emperor of Mali came over here and brought thousands more Africans. And they amalgamated with the ones that was here. And when we came over on the slave ship, that's how the largest group of modern Africans got here. We amalgamated with those two groups. Amalgamation means we married into them. All right? They married into us. If you read LaRonde Bennett, Dr. LaRonde Bennett wrote a book called The Shaping of Black America. He has a chapter in there called The Red and the Black. And we need to buy the book, The Shaping of Black America, which is a very good book. And his second book is Before the Mayflower. Okay, and you want the revised version that LaRonde did before he passed into Ancestry. Those two books, long before we've been hearing the chatter on social media, had already explained that Africans were here before Christopher Columbus, and before the so-called Indians. Another good book on it is by Ivan Van Sertima. The book is called They Came Before Columbus. Okay? But we got defeated by the European nations. And the European nations took the geography we call North America and made it into a political state, in which they held us in slavery for nearly 200 years plus. We were not in slavery in North America 400 years. In the Caribbean and Central South America, they were in slavery, many of the brothers and sisters there, for 400 years. Slavery started in earnest in North America around legalized up in Massachusetts in the 1640s, but you didn't get an appreciable population until the 1670s. Well, it ended in the 1860s. So how long is that? It's really less than 200 years. So you got to be careful what you tell your mind, you know, and then you begin to understand who you are. But racism didn't begin in America. Racism began when we met the first white man. Okay? You go back to ancient Egypt, and you look at how we were treated by the Hyksos in the first invasion of Kemet, and then the Hittites. And when we finally got the real cracker, the Greeks, under Alexander and his general Ptolemy, you see the same kind of caste class racism taking place, not as coarse as here. But we were already being enslaved back then.
Mm.
Then the Roman Empire came in and conquered Kemet and Northeast Africa, which they call Middle East. And then the Roman conquered North Africa. But before the Roman conquered North Africa, yeah, the Roman conquered North Africa. And then they were conquered partially by a group of Germans called the Visigoths or the Vandals that came out of Spain. And then the Muslims, Arabs, Yemenis, and Africans drove the Roman out of North Africa. Now we're up to the 600s, 700s. But racism is already clearly in place. Okay. So we didn't meet the white man in 1492. We met the white man in 3 BC for the first time as a vicious enemy. And that enemy had been encroaching on Africa with wars after wars after wars and enslavement before then. When the white man from Western Europe got to West Africa, the Christians, Protestant white man and the Catholic Church, the Arab and the Turkish slave trade was already 1,500 years old. So they didn't create the slave trade system. They tapped into it and became partners with the system.
Mm-hmm. You
know? So this craziness, like white folks just showed up one day and took us. No, we were already at war for nearly 2,500 years over this issue of captivity, people taking control of our land, people enslaving us into Europe. They were enslaving us into Europe before 1492. Okay.
Wow.
So history, Dr. Nobles, teach us will erase the mystery and let you work your miracle, but you got to understand history, not mystery. History, not myth. History. Mm-hmm. That by the time 1492 occurs and this thing we know as the transatlantic slave trade started, all they had to do is tap into the Turkish, Arab, Muslim slave trading network in Africa and make partnership with them. And that's what they did.
Wow, wow. As we unpack this idea of racism in general, give us a good working definition. We've seen it expressed in so many ways. Give us a good working definition of exactly what it is.
As a process, both in the mind and systemically, is someone having the power and the wealth to impose their prejudice on someone else. Simple as that. Mm-hmm. It makes it too complicated, but it's really simple. But now where do their prejudice come from? You get into the complication. You're dealing with a very inferior people and an inferior culture when you're dealing with the Europeans. The European racism stems from their own inferiority to the black man. Their violence stems from that inferiority. Because if you enslaved me, why are you mad with me? I didn't enslave you. You got to figure out, what is that about? It's about white inferiority and trying to impose that inferiority on you through violence and destruction and death by using his military and economic power to impose his inferior-born prejudice on you, because they know who we are. Just go to any museum in America. It's full of African civilization, all right? You got all our stuff up in there. So it ain't like they don't know who we are, and they say, oh, we thought y'all were ignorant, backwards people out of the trees in Africa. No. Go to Europe. All of their museum is filled with our artifacts, our historical documents, and all of our things. So they know we aren't the inferior being they would like to teach us we are. It is their inferiority that is imposed through violence and prejudice on us. That is what we're calling racism.
Hmm. Well, I have to ask, because when you speak of that inferiority, it obviously causes us as black folks to realize the wisdom and superiority that we have, obviously. Tap into that and give us a glimpse into our heritage as Black folks. What do we not understand about who we are?
Here's the simplest way I tell Black folks: show me a white civilization that has ever been built anywhere in the world. You can't go to the Greeks, because the Greeks had everything they got in all of their writings: Herodotus, Plato, Aristotle, Homer. All of them say we got all of this from Africa. So that rules out the Greek civilization. So where's the civilization that Europeans built? None. When you want to find civilization and kingdoms based on the rules of civilization, you go to Africa, period. Starting with Kerma in the ancient Sudan, just before Kemet, then Kemet, which lasts for God knows how many years, 30, 40,000 years. When you talk about the civilization along the Nile Valley, we don't even get into the great Zimbabwean civilization because we're just learning about it since we've taken over South Africa back from the whites, which may be older than the Kemetic civilization. Then we're talking about the great kingdoms based around the laws and rules of those civilizations of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Borneo, Kilawa, and others. There's nothing like that in Europe. You know, Europe is living in the swamp until the Arabs take them our body of wisdom. The Greeks had taken them some, and they were trying to work off of that.
Hmm.
And out of that, you know, they were able to form what you call Christianity. Christianity started as a political, not a religious system. It morphed into a religious system, all right? The Catholic Church is 1,000 years younger than the Egyptian Coptic Church. But all of the Protestant churches of the West was given birth to by the Catholic Church after Luther's rebellion in, what, the 1500s? So that can't be the genesis of anything. Because you got a church in Ethiopia 1,000 years older than the Roman Catholic Church, which gives birth to all the Western Protestant churches.
Hmm.
You understand that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so once you put some of this into context, you'll realize we're dealing with a historical liar. We're dealing with a historical plagiarist. We're still dealing with a historical terrorist, an economic terrorist, a cultural terrorist, and that's a matter of their policy. Their culture is based on an anti-African terrorism economically, psychologically, culturally, and politically. So when we talk about racism, you're talking about this plagiarized being knowing his inferiority to the African being, enforcing his prejudice and envy and jealousy on the African by force. That's racism. How it manifests itself? It manifests itself in every aspect of the American or Western world culture, because it's not just America. The same thing goes on in Germany and England and France and Holland, etc. You know, we live here, and America has such a big voice in the world. We think racism is just an American thing, but George Floyd showed you it's not just an American thing. We see it in China, and the racism and murderous abuse towards African students and other merchants who are living there. We see it in Japan. Yet Japan's base population, the Ainu, were Black people before the Asiatic invaded the Japanese islands, you know? And you can go and find the base population, the original Aborigines of Vietnam were Black, and many of them still live there. Cambodia, the Aborigine were Black, and many of them still live there. Indian, the Aborigine were Black, and millions still lived there before they were invaded by the same Mongolians we call Indians in America. Study history. It will erase the mystery.
I've got to ask, and it appears, especially, I guess, in this time, in this climate, and I realize that there are other groups of people who have been enslaved before, but it feels as if we are, as blacks, are extremely targeted. Why is that? What is it about us that makes us?
We are the parent people. We are the parent people of the world. Everybody got to live up to our standards, and if they can't, they got to beat us down to theirs. Simple as that. Not complicated. We get caught up in the methodology of oppression rather than the reason for the oppression. Yes, the methodologies, the movies, the books, the magazines, the music, the school system, the political structuring, all of those things are part of the method used, hiring practices, the way you measure people taking tests, but those are the methodologies. The reason is envy, jealousy, and inferiority on the part of the non-parent people. The African is the parent people. When the universe first manifested as a human being, it obviously manifested as a black woman who gave birth to everything else, including the man that would become her man. Nobody can disprove that, you know. That's why I could say we're God having a human experience, because the totality of everything gave birth to itself as a bird at some point. It gave birth to itself as a rose at some point. It gave birth to an aspect of itself, rather, as a human being. And that first time God decided, we can call it any name, Odomari, Yahweh, or whatever you want to call it, Allah, we're talking about the omnipotent, omnipresent, omnipotent causation and sustainer of the universe. When it manifests as a human, it manifests as a black woman who became the parent people for every other human in the world. And so we are talking about genetic envy. And then the other thing that Dr. Francis Welting taught us was that drives the racism, that drives someone using their prejudice to keep you from becoming a legitimate competitor in the marketplace of the world, is the fear, the white man and the white Asians' fear of genetic annihilation. That black penis is very powerful, and so is the black woman. They're going to jump off in there, let it jump off in you, and then you're going to disappear. Okay?
Wow.
That was a simple way to put it and get right to the point.
Yeah, yeah.
Dr. Welting told us the fear of genetic annihilation and the envy and the jealousy coming out of the inferiority towards the parent people is what drives racism. Beyond the obvious of, I don't want you to be a competitor because you will outcompete me, so I can't let you play on a level field, because it's being who you are when given the opportunity, you soar to the top in everything I do. And that's proven in our history all over the Western world. And inventions in science and technology and sports and education. Give us a chance and see where we arrive.
Yeah, yeah, so true. That phrase, the parent people, I can't help but to want to unpack that a little bit. So if we as the African people were the parent people, how do we
We still are the parent people.
We still are the parent people. How do we get to where we are now, seeing the various cultures and Asians, Europeans, Arabs? How do we evolve into what we see today?
Brute violence and warfare, domination, destruction, and death brought to us from our Asian and European brothers. And the fear and disorganization and confusion that has created in the shattering of our cultural spaces, so that we are suffering from what Dr. Nobles call a shattered consciousness and a broken black identity, because our cultural institutions and spiritual centers have been either destroyed, broken, shattered, or captured by an enemy by brute force and warfare based on genocidal behavior towards us who had no war weapons to compete with them. Know your history and it'll erase the mystery.
Wow. I have to unpack a little bit when it comes to what we're seeing today. of course, you mentioned George Floyd, and our hearts continue and prayers continue to go out to him and his family and the many others, because he's just one of them.
Remember, George Floyd is only one of about 4,500 in the last 10 years. So people are crying over George, and he deserved the tears. Well, I and you and many like me in the struggle, we're crying over the 4,400 plus just in the last 10 years. And we're also crying over the 300,000, the 330,000 killed by our own black hands in the last 34 years, 35 years. Mm. But even though it was by our own black hands, those black hands were governed by the white minds that those who socialize us in the education system and won't let us teach our own children, but they don't want to take responsibility for creating the monsters they've sent back to our communities.
Wow, I gotta float that as a balloon. I gotta come back for that, because you mentioned the educational system, and we gotta tap in. But as it pertains to what we're seeing with police brutality in black communities, unpack that a little bit for us. I understand that the police, how they originated, but unpack that for our viewers.
Police brutality is nothing but power unregulated in the hands of an inferior white person who's been given a job by the white holders of wealth in the society to keep the competition in check. Let's tell the shit what it really is. Ain't but some white man don't like you, you know. He has been programmed and socialized from the time he was given birth to by his mama to know that your role is to keep the black man in check so that the ruling elite can be protected from their competition. And your reward is your aspiration, because your skin is white, that you may be a ruling elite one day. See, shit ain't as complicated as we think. Not as complicated as we think. The police department in this country was founded to track down blacks who were runaway enslaved people. And when we started moving into urban centers, they brought in who we call the poor crack or the rednecks from Europe, from the gutters and prison of Europe. And those were the people who became the policemen in the urban center of the Northeast. And not much has changed in terms of attitude and strategies from the 1800s to now.
Well, I know there are other cultures that are represented in police departments.
They're not other cultures. There are other genetic ethnic groups represented, but there's only one culture, and that is the culture of European inferiority and European domination, destruction, violence, and death. That's the only culture that's represented there, whether it's an Asian face, a Latino face, or a black face. The culture, the rules, the protocols, the principle by which all of them operate, even our own people, is based on domination, destruction, and death, if that's what it takes to keep the black population from being a competitor in the economic, social, and cultural marketplace against white people who are inferior on any level we compete with them on.
Wow. You touched on the education system and system as a whole.
It's key to racism. The education system is key to racial domination of black people, more significant than the police department.
So is that where this whole school to prison pipeline comes from?
Yeah, that term is cool. I don't like that term, but Sister Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, should be a must read by all black people, especially the youth. And the second book is called The Criminalization of a Race. The Criminalization of a Race by Dr. Shashi McIntyre. Those two books will put this in context in a way you've never looked at it, you know. And when then you'll understand this is about keeping the African from being a competitor in the economic marketplace. So if you can go back to 1921, what is it, 21 or 25, when they burned down Greenwood, Black Wall Street, and Tulsa. They didn't go burn them down because a bunch of white folks didn't like a bunch of black folks. They said, oh, hell no. That black community over there in town is outdoing us in the economic marketplace. Pretty soon, they'll own Tulsa. The burning down of Wilmington, North Carolina, and the murdering of hundreds, if not thousands, of black people and burning their business and wealth after the Civil War when they had taken over Wilmington and was running the government was about we cannot allow them to set a model of black achievement and black success after we said you're inferior. And you pop right out of slavery and you running banks and insurance companies and schools and government, hell no. So we must do something. So the genocide and the terrorism, who they blame on the Ku Klux Klan, well, who are the Ku Klux Klan but the white community wearing a robe? Sanctioned by the elected politicians and the law enforcement mechanism in the jurisdiction they were in. No Klan could have functioned without the sanctioning of law enforcement and the sanctioning of the political leadership. The Ku Klux Klan was nothing but an arm of the American government and still is by whatever name they operate. Right now, they operate as the police departments in most jurisdictions around the country. So you don't have to wear a white robe anymore and come in the night. I've given you the laws necessary to do the same thing to black people that the Ku Klux Klan was doing to black people. But now it's under the color of law and under the protection of the jurist system in the country. So you have even the Supreme Court making a decision that protects policemen when they kill somebody. You remember that same Supreme Court in the case of the Dred Scott decision, they're the one that says we had no right that white people were obligated to respect. That's the Supreme Court of the United States. It was the Supreme Court of the United States that said we could be separate but equal but never enforce any equalness on our side. So the Klan and the terrorist organization that have enforced not white supremacy because they're not supreme to anything, that has enforced white dominance through genocide and murder has always been an arm of the government, however they disguised it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned as it pertains to mass education, them, I guess the powers that be trying to keep us suppressed and not knowing our genius as a people. Is that why we only see a handful or maybe one or two blacks in history that are celebrated?
There's millions more that should be celebrated.
Yeah.
But just in
your... But on a grand scale, we only see a couple.
Right. I did a lot of work in Detroit with my teachers, Dr. Asa Hilliard, Dr. Van, Dr. Clark, Dr. Leonard Jeffries, Dr. Jacob Carruthers, helping to put into place one of the most unique African-centered school system in the country. And the Negroes and the white folks went out of their way to destroy the most highly rated school system in the country, the destroyed school system, which was the most black-centered school system in the country. They destroyed it to such a degree the state had to take over 20 years later. But we don't know that Detroit had all these African-centered schools. We don't know the work Dr. Ben put in, the work Dr. Asa Hilliard put in, the work Dr. Wade Noble put in Detroit, the work Dr. Jacob Carruthers put in Detroit, helping to organize those African-centered curriculums. Because when you don't know the history, you're subject to somebody else's mystery.
Yes, so true. When it comes to our response to the racism and the brutality against black people here, we see a lot of protesters. We see a lot of marches. What are your thoughts on that? Is that a good place to start?
Well, remember this, that's a good place. Any weapon you can use, anytime people wake up to a wrong and they use whatever method they have to try to correct the wrong, that's a good thing. It may not be what I would love to see. It may not have gone as far as I would like it to go. But they've gone further than anybody has ever gone thus far in terms of a mass response to the recognition of white racism and its manifestation of murder and genocide against the African people, because that's what they responded to. And so, and it will achieve some things. It will cause some changes, and they have to be praised for it. Well, those young people, I can't march now. My knees all banged up at my age, you know what I'm saying? But in my day, I marched with Dr. King. I marched with Dr. Powell. I marched with Reverend Shopton. I marched with many others through the years. Marched against the Pentagon with the SDS and all the crazy white brothers, you know what I'm saying? So I was out there. We did what we could. And marching is not obsolete. It's just one weapon. And we can't expect one weapon to solve all the problems, okay?
Hmm.
One of the things the community have to do now, if all white policemen in the country fell in love with black folks and never kill another black person in the next 100 years, right, and COVID go away tomorrow, we'll be in the same situation we were in before it all started. You know why? Because we do not control the economics, the politics, and the culture where we live. We do not own the real estate and manage land, labor, and resources where we live, okay? We're not the primary provider of food, clothing, shelter, and safety for our children, our women, and our family where we live. And until we address that, until we stop giving money to these other ethnic groups to take out of our community at the end of the day and go build their communities, while we complain and saying we ain't got no money. Yeah, you just gave it to somebody else to go build their ethnic community. They didn't take that money that you spend at the Arab store, or at the Chinese store, or at the Korean store, or at the Jewish store, or at the Italian or Polish store. They did not take that money and reinvest it in inner city Detroit where black people live. They run the businesses there. We are 100% of their customers, but they take that money where they live and reinvest it. Okay? That's the real deal. Because racism won't affect us if we get our mind back. The way you get your mind back is realizing that you're responsible for the provision of food, clothing, shelter, safety, and security for yourself and your family. You cannot do that unless you take control of the economics, the politics, and the culture where you live. Malcolm X told us that we need to do that. Dr. King said we need to do that. Elijah Muhammad said we need to do it. Harriet Tubman said we needed to do it. Marcus Garvey said we need to do it. Ida B. Wells said we need to do it. Maggie Walker said we needed to do it. What's our other sister, Madam C.J. Walker? Said, so we've had great minds come telling us what the formula is. The formula is don't shop where you don't own. Period. Especially don't shop where you can't work. Don't spend your money unless they show you how they're going to reinvest some of that money in the community you live in. So you can have your daycare facilities and your retirement homes, all right? Then the other piece we got to do, young black people and older black people have to stop saying, I'm not going to get involved in politics. Then you need to move to another country because you're in my way. You move someplace else. Stop playing. Or I'm not an American. Stop being silly. Geopolitically, if you live in the United States and you pay your tax here and you earn your money here and you own your home here and you pay your mortgage here, you're an American. Stop lying to yourself.
Mm.
But America is not a race. This is a geopolitical place. I'm an African, racially. And what comes with being African is a history, a culture, and a value system. If I begin to learn it, that will inform me, right, that my history and culture will inform me in whose interest I must behave economically, politically, and culturally in order to provide food, clothing, shelter, safety for myself and my family. And I can only do that if I take control of the economic, politics, and culture where I live.
Yeah.
That means if I don't like who the Democratic Party is running for office or the Republican Party is running for office or the Socialist Party is running for office, then run myself or my comrade or my worker or my friend. But we can't do that unless we learn how the election laws work in our jurisdiction. We got to know how to get a petition. We got to know how to have the courage to go around the community and get the community to sign your petition. to put you on a ballot so we can run the criminals out of office. But just sitting there saying that criminals in office, yeah. But the next step is what we're going to do about getting those criminals out of the way, and most of them look just like us, and get people in those offices. I mean, we must learn, just like how we can sit down on Sunday and watch the football game and the baseball game and the basketball game and know every player on the team and know their stats, know their wife's name, their girlfriend's name, their mama baby name. We learn all of that about these guys. Know it like that. But we don't know where our polling place is, many of us. We don't know who is our city council person. We don't know who our school board person is. We don't know who our community board person is. All right? We don't know who the district attorney is, who's prosecuting all of our babies every day on false crimes and false charges. We've got to become literate, politically literate. Right now, a large segment of our community is politically ignorant. And that ignorance has become one of the greatest enemy of our communities. So we've got to become politically literate, culturally literate, economically literate. Most of our people know most of any group goes to college. So we need to become the plumbers. Every house in America needs a plumber, people. We need to become the electrician. Every house in America needs electricity at some point. We need to become house painters. Every house in America just might need to be painted at some point. We need to become, you know.
Yeah.
You understand me?
Yes,
but
sir.
Somehow our enemy, who have been controlling the public school system with laws that our own people helped to make, who are in these positions we elected them to, have blocked us from having the control of our local school system that would allow us to have the kinds of programs. Even Trump is calling for these kinds of programs that would teach us the vocational skills it takes to run a community and to sustain a community and to make capital so you can open your own credit union and your own banks.
You mentioned something. You mentioned marching with King and many others. I've heard people say in my conversation, integration did not help us as a people. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the first thing, Dr. King wasn't marching for integration. Okay. He was marching for desegregation. White folks used their media to turn our movement from desegregation into an integration movement. It was not an integration movement. We were trying to say, if my tax pay for the school and you putting all of the equipment in the school and all of the tools the child needs, then my child should have the right to go to the school. But that's my tax money that bought the school. All right. My tax money is running these buses and trains, so I got a right based on my tax money to sit anywhere on the buses and train I want to sit. Okay? I live in a country where my fathers have fought in every war in this nation, then I have the right to seek work on an equal footing in any industry in the nation without being discriminated against because I'm an African. That's what we were fighting for. White folks created this whole integration concept, and the people bought into it not understanding what they were buying into, and what integration turned out to be, the dismantling of the black economic structure and the patronizing of the white economic structure in the communities we live in. And so now in the 60s, when we fought to reverse that in the late 60s, early 70s, and we drove the white merchants out of our community, they replaced them with immigrants of color who we thought welcome as brothers and sisters, but they operate like an ally of the people we ran out, not like brothers and sisters. What's real is real. And we need to tell the truth, and the condition is there. And the other piece, if you don't control your school system, you're not in control of the minds of your children. And so what you're going to get at the end of the day is the product we're getting now that white folks have created that goes in what they call the pipelines prison. They created that by making sure you don't have local community control over the schools, that the community can't determine what's in the curricula, that we can't decide who the principal is going to be, and we can't decide who the teachers are going to be. So all the young white women who couldn't get no job anywhere because they had their little liberal arts degrees, you create Teach America and gave them a 6-month course and stuck them in our community with a little sick backward racist points of view to teach our children a sick racist curricula that you designed to make sure they couldn't learn to compete with you in the technical marketplace of America. And if you think this is a joke, go and do a research on the Mohawk Education Conference that was held in upstate New York at the turn of the 19th century or the 20th century, then the 19th century. And you will see, headed by Rutherford B. Hayes, the same white man who became president after Johnson, who was Lincoln's vice president, and they cut a deal to make this northern white man, Hayes, Rutherford B. Hayes, the president, and the deal they cut with the Confederate South, which we still fight in today over these statues, another thing, was that if you let the northern bankers put their man, Mr. Hayes, in office, so we can hook up international trade and commerce like we want to, we'll pull the federal troops out of the South, and you can put the black folks into slavery, except we won't call it slavery this time. We'll call it sharecropping, and they can still produce the cotton and the things we need for northern industry, and then the Confederacy, y'all can come back, because we're going to pardon all of y'all, and y'all can come back and run the South. That same man, Mr. Rutherford B. Hayes, is the chairman of the Conference on Education called the Mohawk Education Conference, and the conference was about what is going to be the education model for the Negroes. Because we can't teach them to compete against us.
Wow.
And it was, I think it's the Anglican Church or the Presbyterian Church that paid for it and backed it, along with certain banks. That is the model of education our children are going through in the school right now, to minimize and marginalize their math skills and their science skills and their intellectual skills so they can't compete against the white youth jobs in America.
Wow. So as an educator, now that we, I guess, are fortunate enough to have our kids at home, even though they may be matriculating through the school system, but we can expose them to other things, what should we be teaching them during this time?
We should be doing it. Every black community first should be fighting to take control of the taxpayer-owned schools. Those aren't their schools. Those are your schools. And if the political people you've elected won't do it, vote their asses out of office and put people in who will do it. But while that process is going on, and put pressure on these churches. We ended dancing and singing and doing the monkey shine every Sunday in the name of the Lord that keeps us in poverty. I don't care who like it. If it ain't the truth, then go to your Bible. It says, know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Matter of fact, your Bible don't say God will set you free. It don't say Christianity will set you free. It says truth alone will set you free. So let's play with the truth. So we've got 90% of our people in the churches, 10% in the mosque. And they're all hooping and hollering to one God or another that some of our enemy, enslaving enemy, gave to us. Instead of turning those churches and those mosques into after-school programs for our children to teach our history, to teach them math, and to teach them science, because the system is not going to do it until we take control of the system. But that's going to take time because we've been fighting for that for a long time. But they can't stop you from using your mosque and using your church to set up after-school programs. Tutoring program, not for a select few in the neighborhood, but for any child in the neighborhood. And we'll turn this thing around overnight. And in each household, every black family, whether it's a single parent, woman or man, if you're a damn family, you're family. And ain't no single parent family, because that's crap. Because whatever sister ain't got no husband, she got a boyfriend. And whatever brother ain't got no wife, he got a girlfriend. So stop playing this single parent crap, because that ain't never really been true. Maybe the married partner was there, but another partner was there because y'all didn't all go celibate overnight, okay? Stop playing. Let's get real and tell the truth. And so every household should set aside 2 hours a week, that's all, to teach history to your children. Your history. And 1 hour a week at least, maybe two on separate days, to teach mathematics to your children. And you'll turn this thing around in a way you didn't know it. But If you don't have self-worth, self-value, self-esteem, I don't care who's trying to teach you. Very few will get it.
Yeah, yeah, that's so true. I've got to discuss this. I know we alluded to desegregation, which evolved into integration, but we are seeing now many whites and blacks who are communing together and cohabitating. And
we've been cohabitating as long as we've been in America. That's why they had laws against cohabitation. You don't make laws for things that ain't happening. Okay, so let's get that piece out of the way. Matter of fact, when we go back, remember you asked how racism started. You go back to 17, but it's 26, 16, 19, 17, 26, in Jamestown, Virginia, the Baker Rebellion, the first rebellion in America, led by a young white man from England. Most of his troops were black people who had began to be caught up in the enslaved process. And they had to bring the British Army in because they rebelled for about a year, an armed rebellion, right? So they had to bring the British Army in, bring a whole shipload of soldiers from England to put the rebellion down. You know, the first thing they did was to pass a law that black men can't marry white women. First thing they did. Second thing they did, black men couldn't own weapons. So you want to know when it started in America? There, at the end of the Baker's Rebellion.
Hmm. So how do we manage our relationships? Because there are many whites that don't agree with racism.
There's always been whites who didn't agree with racism. It ain't for us to manage it. They need to go manage their people. Their people are practicing the racism. You know, we've never had any vengeance process going on against any whites. We've received any whites who come into our space with the kind of respect human beings should for the most part. So that ain't an issue with us. The issue is, don't come telling me how you're not racist. Go tell your people how they need to stop being racist. That's your job, because I can't do that. Be a model for your people of how not to be a racist, and then stand up like many are doing right now, and I give credit, because their lives have been in danger in the past and is in danger now in the same way ours was from the sick minds who have bought into I'm superior when they're really acting out a notion of inferiority. And so we have always been in partnership with whites. There's never been a period in the country when whites and blacks didn't have some sort of partnership. We were voting long before the civil rights laws were passed in many states. Matter of fact, when the Civil War started, where do you think the largest black free population was in America?
What, maybe 40%? 60%?
No, what state do you think it was in?
Oh, what state? That's a tough one. Virginia, maybe?
Some people would say Virginia because that's about as far south as it can go. Most people would say New York or Jersey or Boston, but it was Mississippi.
Mm. Wow.
And so when the Civil War starts, there's nearly 400,000 free black people in America, with a large segment of them living in the South. Okay? But that discussion don't get had. And you can't have that unless there's some kind of relationship between blacks and whites. So this isn't about, it's today we talk about it like it's about an individual white decision. No. What we're calling racism is state-sponsored, psychosocial, cultural, and economic terrorism against the black population to keep them from becoming competitors in the marketplace. And that's only one level, because we can outcompete them any day of the year and you give us a halfway fair chance. But the second piece is the black community in America, which is about the fifth or sixth largest black nation in the world, got the significant power in America economically. What does that say about our ability to free Africa economically?
Yeah.
Where the wealth of the world is still being extorted and stolen from.
Yeah, yeah. You're a world traveler, and Africa is like home to you. Give us a glimpse into what that climate is like.
Well, mad with me now because I made a scathing criticism of some African brothers on 125th Street about 5 years ago, and somebody had said they took the 4 minutes out of the hour and 45 minutes of circulating around the world, but 4 minutes can't define 55 years of my struggling for African freedom. So I just laugh at it. And most of the response have actually been very positive, and it has forced everybody to have a discussion on why we have hundreds of thousands of brothers and sisters who are coming from the continent here looking for a better life economically like everybody else in the world, but they're not merging with our community and amalgamating with our community, meaning the African-American community, in the way Italians amalgamate with Italians, or Poles with Poles, or Jews with Jews, or Latinos with Latinos. Why is our people building separate communities and being incessant? And we're the only one doing that. Or our people will come and they land in our community. They're Baptists just like us, but they don't come to my Baptist church. They go build a separate Baptist church, you see. And so those are things we need to think. And I know why. When you're an immigrant, you can't fight the way we're fighting, and I don't expect you to. But I don't expect you to line up with my enemy against my fight. Okay? Because I know you can't do this because you got other issues, and I'm supposed to help you with your immigration issues so that you don't get abused by the state. But you have to make a step, too, towards grabbing my hands, you know? Because everybody that comes to this country, brown and black and yellow, first thing they say, I'm a minority, because that's the code word. Give me whatever black Americans have fought for and won. But when you get it, then you take on another identity that don't associate with black Americans, and you try to identify me by the poorest of my people by saying, well, you're all about the thug life. The thug life? Every Latin country, Asian country, and African country, their prisons are all full, and there ain't no white folks running those countries. So please talk to me. Let's have a real conversation about how the race needs to relate in America. Because I know the State Department tell our brothers and sisters who are coming, whether they come in as refugee or as immigrants, you know, with visas or travel, they're told not to associate with us, not to be in our community, not to join our organization. Our government tells people this. And of course, people are frightened and intimidated. I've come here to try to make a living, so I'm not going to do nothing to jeopardize that. And I understand that. But after you've been here 10 or 20 years, you know better. After you've gained American citizenship, you know better. How are you behaving now? I got Howard University. I got Mahaffey University. I got Spelman University. I got more colleges in America that's just dedicated to black people, run by black people, than half of the African continent has. Not half, but one-third.
One-third, yeah.
And then we kicked the doors in on every white college in America and made space for all of us. We never said this is just for black Americans. We made space for the continental African. We made space for the Puerto Rican, the Dominican, the Latinos from Mexico. We made space for the Asian. But how many people are going into the industry after getting the education we made space for and making space for us? There's some serious questions to be asked. So people stop playing, because we ain't blind. And with our numbers, we're 50 million strong. What if we stop supporting the business of the immigrants who mostly are lodged in our community? Where would you be?
Yeah.
So before we flip and turn on you, you better sit down and have a conversation about how we're going to work together.
So true. You mentioned when we were talking
about... only take abuse and suffering and being preyed on by anybody but so long.
Yeah.
And you've seen us explode in America every now and then. When we explode, we can explode and burn everything down. People say, when you burn your own community, man, it don't belong to us. It's a neighborhood I live in. It's only a community when I own the businesses. And if I don't own the businesses and I burn it down, I'm not burning my community down. I'm burning their community down, in which I'm a neighbor.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we were talking about...
Go ahead. Let me just straighten that up real quick, because I don't want people
to see. Go ahead, Professor.
See, a neighborhood is defined as a geographical location where people who have the common religion, use their common language, common culture, and common history live. But a community is all of that, and you own the land, and you control the politics and the economics. Only then is it a community. If you don't control the politics, economics, and culture where you live in somebody else's neighborhood, whether it look like you or not.
Mm.
And most of them don't live there. They own your neighborhood, but they don't live in your neighborhood. But they own the real estate. They own the retail business. They own the wholesale business. That's their neighborhood. I mean, that's their community. It's just your neighborhood.
Wow. Mm, that's heavy. So we got a lot more work to do than we think.
Mm-hmm. We got a lot of work to do. But we first have to deal with the basics. How do I provide what I'm obligated to do, food, clothing, shelter, safety, and security to me and my family? I got to control the economic politics and country where I live. Not have some other ethnic group because they're brown or beige or light, control it, and then take the money that I make and the jobs I do have to his community, build up his safety, send his children to college, be able to control his schools. And I'm sitting around like a fool with people shooting at my babies every night because y'all done drive them crazy in a school system where you have them from the time they're 4 years old until they're 18 and they can't write when they get out or read. And you told me you were paid hundreds of thousands of dollars with $500,000 worth of retirement fund, and you that's what you gave me. And the only solution you have is to send them to prison and make them a greater predator on my community, then turn and blame it and get the hell out of the schools. Let us run our own schools. Let us control who's the principal. Let us control the school boards. Let us write the curricula. Let us create the socialization process. And socialization is how people get their values, interests, and principles. Let us create the socialization process by the running of our education system with a curricula designed by our community, which we don't have to look for because many of our scholars have designed tons of them over the last few decades. You get the hell out of my community and go run your own so that mine can become mine in the way yours is yours.
Now, when you talk about taking our or building community, if we were to stop spending money, just the very essentials, groceries, we don't own any of those. So how do we just start that process?
Look at what just happened. When COVID came, all those stores closed. Didn't we survive? It's been 6 months now. Most of those closed stores closed. All right? But we survived. Grocery. We got these big churches where 90% of our people go. Hooping and hollering. Yeah, I don't care if y'all get mad. Y'all hooping and hollering because you ain't producing no sovereignty for your people. Now tell me about the Lord. That don't work. Let's deal with what's real. Same thing go for the mosque. Same thing go for the Yoruba community and the Akan. I want to hear that stuff. Let's deal with real. Spirituality is being in control of your reality. And if that ain't what your spirituality is about, it ain't spiritual. So let's come down. We got all these buildings with all of these organizations called congregations that can pool their money. They already pooled it when they put it in that plate in church, except it's not being pooled just for the preacher's house and a few deacons that can pool their money and rent their truck and go to any